welcome to the 79th episode of Reverse Threat Radio. I'm Andy Ryan.
And I'm Toby Chad.
And 61 years to the day that England skittled from New Zealand for just 26 in Auckland, the lowest ever score in a test match. Welcome to the podcast that's hoping for a repeat on Wednesday.
And just in case anyone hasn't been keeping up with the news, obviously what's happening on Wednesday is that England meet New Zealand in the semi-final. No quarter-finals in this World Cup, one of the quirks of it. In the semi-final of the T20 World Cup, we're going to be talking about that World Cup. We've also got all kinds of other bits and pieces in this episode. We're going to be talking about the forthcoming English County Championship season. We're going to be talking about the legend that is Shahid Afridi and his departure from the scene. Andy's going to be talking to us about the rich history of the benefit season and the benefit match, which is not the same, by the way, for any viewers of television as Benefit Street. It's quite different altogether, in fact. We're going to be reviewing 10 for 10, which is the story of Hedley Verity's remarkable spell as well. Just to start off, perhaps with the World 2020, I've been watching a lot of it over the last couple of weeks from Sydney. And one thing that I've actually really, I mean, we talk a lot about 2020 on this podcast, and we talk a lot about the fact that we talk a lot about 2020 on this podcast. And one of the things that I've actually been really encouraged about with this World Cup has been the fact that however many years on we are now, 10 years on from the real kind of global launch of 2020, that actually the desire of particularly batsmen to kind of continually innovate doesn't seem to have been baited at all. I was really kind of pleased and amused by the moment when Steve Smith walked probably, you know, more than 2 yards outside his off stump well before the ball had been bowled by Wahab Riaz in Australia's match against Pakistan. Riaz kind of completely freaked out, completely failed to do what any sane bowler would do, namely bowl it at the stumps,
which was particularly disappointing because Riaz had early cleaned up Khawaja with a beautiful Yorker, and had he bowled exactly the same ball to Smith, you know, and Riaz bowls 90 so comfortably, you'd have thought that would have been way too much.
It would absolutely have been way too much, but the point was, I think he was just so taken aback by what on earth is he doing. I mean, it genuinely looks as if he was just kind of walking off the pitch and giving up. He was so far outside his off stump by the time the ball had actually been bowled, and I just wonder whether there was that kind of sense in Wahab's mind of how on what's actually going on here. I haven't faced this kind of thing before, because unlike the Khawaja ball, which was just, you know, full and fast for a batsman who was standing there, this was just a complete unknown to him.
No, and I think the other issue is there's always this bit of machismo. I mean, I love watching Wahab Riaz bowl, but there's that aspect of him that I think he was angry rather than focused at that stage. He maybe wasn't thinking quite as rationally as he might have been. And I see you also enjoyed Virat Kohli's masterclass against Australia.
Yeah, so the kind of the must-win game between Australia and India that happened, well, depending where you are in the world, last night Australian time, or whenever that translates to English time or any other time, the must-win game between Australia and India. Obviously, India were really under the pump, chasing at the end of their innings. They needed to make, I think it was about 14 and over off the last sort of 8 overs or so. And Virat Kohli, you know, he's he can hit sixes. He doesn't have any problem in that regard. But he batted really interestingly and just kind of drew back actually from going for the big shots, just continually hit fours and pick gaps in the field and really forced the bowlers to try and do something a bit different against him, and therefore, you know, bowl a few more four balls, as it were, and actually ended up getting the total really, really comfortably. So those were just for me two examples of what I think has been a really kind of encouraging signs that in this 2020 things have changed a bit.
That you've said you've been watching loads of it. If I was the T20 World Cup's marketing guru, I'd be delighted, because I would have had you down as one of their hard to reach demographics, and they've obviously, if they've won you over, then, you know, the sky's the limit.
They could have won anyone over. Now, in the meantime, you've been focusing your attentions closer to closer to home.
Yep, the time for munching on too many Scotch eggs, struggling with the crossword, pretending that it's hot enough to be wearing a t-shirt and shorts, all while watching superb cricket is nearly here. I am, of course, talking about the start of the county cricket season that is only a couple of weeks away. And my appetite for this season has been whetted by reading the other day the extraordinary list of overseas players who are coming over. So bowling-wise, we've got the fiery Wahab Riaz, who we've just discussing. He's coming down to Essex. But even more exciting, I think, than that is the arrival of Kagiso Rabada, who I reckon might just be the most exciting pace prospect in world cricket right now.
Tell us a bit more about him.
Well, so Rabada was really, having had some promising one-day appearances, really burst onto the scene in the England-South Africa Test Series, where kind of out of nothing, you know, he suddenly really became the leader of that South African attack. And I think what's so impressive about him is not only is he actually very young, I mean, he looks incredibly young, but he was bowling with, you know, you can expect a young pace bowler to bowl with raw pace. There was a real intelligence to what he was doing. And I think what's really exciting about this is quite a few of these internationals are just coming over for T20 stuff, just coming over for limited over stuff. Rabada's coming for County Championship because he wants to learn. He wants to learn in English conditions. Be fascinating to see, although possibly a little bit scary for England going forward. Furthermore, within walking distance, I'm going to have Brendan McCullum playing at Middlesex, you know, one of the great batsmen of the, well, certainly one of the most exciting batsmen of our era, round the corner, which will be great. And given my love of the West Indies side, two of their real all-action all-rounders are coming over. So we've got Darren Sammy at Hants, Dwayne Brava will be at Surrey. And I think it is a reminder that we're all determined, I think, to talk about county cricket as this unfashionable relic that's fallen behind the Big Bash and everything. And in many ways, it probably has. But it's encouraging to see that lots of great players don't agree.
Will you be getting a season ticket anywhere?
Well,
obviously,
do you
you're
know
just
what?
You're just down
do
the
you
road
know
from
what?
just
I've,
down the road from Lords.
Do you know what? I've been really wrestling with that very, very question. But you know, I kind of thought, well, I am now, you know, I previously where I lived, I was pretty close to the Oval. I'm now pretty close to Lords, and I have really been wrestling with it. But I haven't quite come down. You know, the basic depressing thing about this is if you happen to have the real inconvenience to cricket watching that is a job, it really is quite hard to get down for the number of days
yeah.
that quite make it worthwhile. That being said, membership at Lords is a real treat because it gives you free roaming of the pavilion. You know, you can pretend you're an MCC member even though you're not really. So
and
maybe,
the,
yeah,
wear
maybe
the tie
I'll cave
and all
in.
That kind of thing.
Exactly. Maybe I'll cave in and get it. Who knows? Now, from the sort of positive, happy aspect of the game, you've been focusing on a really kind of a pretty sad story.
Yeah, I don't know if this has actually hit the news in the UK, but certainly it's been quite a big deal here. So pitch vandalism is something that's been around in cricket for a little while. Been no stranger to it ever since. I mean, the famous one is 1975 when in the Ashes Test at Headingley, the pitch was dug up, I think, ahead of the last day to raise awareness of the plight of a guy called George Davis, who was a minicab driver who had been sentenced to prison for armed robbery and was subsequently the sentence was found to be unstable. Is that the right phrase? I don't know if it is, but anyway, it was overturned, and so the kind of it sort of works that raising of awareness. The latest chapter in the unfortunate history of pitch vandalism happened here in Australia, down in Victoria, where in a club in the middle of the countryside, two teams turned up on the second day of a quite important sort of local game to discover that the pitch had been dug up at both ends, basically where it was sort of on a length where the ball would pitch, and that this kind of oily, sticky substance had been poured all over the pitch. The game was a vital one for the wonderfully kind of mouthy Kingsville Baptist Church Cricket Club. You can imagine that shouting that from first slip in encouragement. Who basically, if they won, they went into the finals of the kind of local league. And the thinking is that actually someone from one of the opposing teams came along and vandalised the pitch in the night in order to stop them winning, because the rules of the league are such that a pitch is vandalized and the game is abandoned, no one gets points, and they just needed to. They were in a very strong position to win that game by the second day, and if they won it, they would get the points to progress. And also the fact that, you know, the covers were put back on the pitch after the vandalism had happened. Clearly, the vandals knew something about cricket because they focused their efforts on digging it up on a length, so that, you know, there was absolutely no chance of the game going ahead. And it's just, you know, unlike the incident at Headingley, where it was kind of a political reason outside cricket causing a pitch to be dug up. It's just, you know, it's really crossing a line when we get to the
It's
stage
kind
that
of it.
someone's willing to destroy a pitch for the sake of stopping another team progressing.
Yeah, it's extraordinary to see the sort of what is effectively, I guess, village cricket being taken quite so seriously. Because I almost think, well, those rules sound a bit unfair, but then I think, why on earth should the rules be designed to stop people vandalizing? You know, you shouldn't even be thinking about that. Now,
Well,
had
exactly.
yeah, and ha so it this has had attention in Australia beyond just the cricketing community. This has had sort of higher level attention than
Well, it
that.
has. I mean, and Australia, in both a stereotypical and non-stereotypical way, is a place that, you know, pays a lot of attention to cricket more generally. But I think it's also sort of really come across as something that's challenged people's ideas of fair play and the kind of things that, you know, because Australia does have a notion of cricket as a game that is played hard, but that, you know, this kind of stuff should not happen in. So it has been, you know, pretty significantly sort of reported on the main pages of newspapers and things like that, because, you know, in reality, no one really cares about whether the
No.
King's or Baptist Church Cricket Club were going to beat the Sunshine Heights Cricket Club. There's another great name. But I think the point is that it's just endemic of something else, you know, more broadly quite worrying, which is to what extent will people go to win social cricket matches?
It's just this difficult question of things just being taken that little bit too seriously. You want people to care, but not care that much. Just as a very quick aside, this reminds me of the entirely futile pitch protection measure that my beloved club, Pinckney's Green, takes after every game, where we put these ropes around the pitch. You have to put these metal poles in these holes around the pitch, put these ropes around the pitch, and this is a much cause of much chagrin to the players who just cannot see the point of this. As you may guess, I'm one of these players, because if you obviously wanted to, you know, get to the pitch, these ropes are in no way a deterrent or a problem, but every game we put them there,
But
and to
isn't
be
but is
fair,
but
no
is
one's poured oil over the pitch, so you know, maybe
but
they
does
were.
but does isn't it designed just to say, please don't come and play football on this
That's
specific
true. I
area, or
think it's
please don't
more of
come
a
and walk your dog
hint.
across this specific
Pa
area, as
perhaps
opposed
it's
to
more of a
actually
hint rather than a
realistically, you know, trying to
protection
stop
measure,
people
isn't it?
from going in? But you know, now we've heard you say that, you know, on record, we'll know that if someone digs up the Pinckney's green pitch, then
It was me
anyway.
protecting my own pitch.
So away from rural cricket in Australia, Shahid Afridi, I made mention of earlier, the boom boom.
Yeah, well, I've never really understood that. There's a sort of quite a cynical school of thought around Shahid Afridi, and I hear this a lot, particularly from a lot of English cricket fans who just don't get him, who say, you know, his figures don't justify the awe in which he is held in by Pakistan fans. And the reason I've never understood this is with Afridi, it's always been about the style as much as the results. He has a fiercely proud, unflinching approach to the game, and I think that means a lot to fans who've been got so used to watching their team messed around in so many different ways. And his final game in world cricket, if his retirement is to be believed, because he has come back from retirement before, was the T20 group game against Australia. And it was a painful reminder of the fact that so few athletes get the farewell they deserve. Afridi suffered a rather miserable double humiliation. First, he was utterly outfoxed by the young Aussie spinner Adam Zampa, who looked like a sort of, you know, a kind of overgrown schoolchild in comparison to, you know, especially to Afridi, who's a sort of real man mountain of a guy. And watching Zampa just outclass Afridi was a sad way for that to end. And then he had to sit in the dugout and watch his team meekly surrender defeat in a fashion that goes completely against the way he's ever played the game. And I think more movingly for me, he was holding back tears by the end in that final over. You could see it was not the way he wanted to go.
From the archives, in this episode, Andy is going to be telling us about something that we've read a lot about and has kind of crossed our paths quite often, but which we've never looked at in a huge degree of detail, and that is the benefit season.
Now, the idea of cricketers being rewarded for loyal service with the chance to make some extra money originated in the 19th century. Of course, this was a time when pro cricketers weren't paid great wages, and the idea was that the sum of money raised would be the basis for a new career. So, for example, an awful lot of pubs were bought with the proceeds of benefits. It also just represented wonderful opportunities for supporters to show their appreciation for a specific player. Now, today we're obviously very familiar with the idea of a benefit season, a series of events lasting a whole year, organised often by quite a substantial committee of various worthy folk. Previously, however, there was usually just a single game designated as the benefit match, and players were allowed to keep the profit from this game. Now, although this was a generous act, it obviously did leave players desperately praying for good weather. I mean, a couple of days of rain, and suddenly your pub is looking more like a sort of, well, you know, a kind of large box at best.
I'd always been familiar with the idea of, you know, the gate receipts go towards a particular player or something like that, and I'd sort of come across instances where the crowd is invited to, you know, particularly up in Northern England. I know it was a very big thing in the kind of in the Lancashire League and the Nelson League and things like that. It's that interesting thing about the crowd. It's the one opportunity that crowds have to actually give money towards a particular player, because otherwise, you know, you pay your money when you go into a match, but actually in terms of being able to say, oh, I came here to see, you know, whoever it was, Leary Constantine, for instance, to take an example from the Nelson League, that actually you get that opportunity. So actually, you know, it's quite an appealing thing for the sake of the crowd as well, isn't it? In that sense of actually giving money towards a specific, saying you yourself have given me pleasure, rather than just the kind of general game.
Yeah, I think so, and I think, as you say, it's much nicer than giving it to sort of the amorphous blob that is kind of the county or the club. And I think it is this point that at that time, you know, your donation, your ticket that day, you were setting someone up for a future career. You know, a lot of these people were retiring at an age without the funding to really see themselves onto something new, so you were making a real contribution. Now, what goes on in a modern benefit season? They actually tend to consist of a fairly standard spread of events. Plenty of dinners are a key part of it. A golf day now seems increasingly popular, and a cricket game, although they don't tend to now be a sort of county game that the proceeds are given to. It tends to be sort of a fun kind of that player's 11 versus his mate's 11 kind of thing. I think particular credit must go to Gloucestershire's New Zealand international Hamish Marshall for livening up his benefit season last year with an invitation to spend an evening with two hookers. Now, the hookers in question were, in fact, rugby players Lee Mears and Anton Oliver. We can only hypothesise at whether the more lurid alternative would have raised him more money. But yeah, credit to Hamish.
And indeed, how many people turned up
with disappointed
expectations,
yeah,
and suddenly were disappointed to see two, you know, 5-foot-tall burly rugby players doing their thing.
But no, I'm sure it was an interesting evening regardless. Now, this always struck me as being a basic unfairness to the benefit system, because those players who probably need the benefit the least tend to do best, while the solid, unspectacular county pros who could probably do with the cash tend to struggle in comparison. Because obviously big names are more of a draw in themselves, but they're also able to get other big name players involved. So to give you an example from last year, Graham Onions was able to host a dinner with Alistair Cook, and Ravi Bapara was able to host one with Kevin Peterson. As a little aside on Peterson, actually, it's really interesting to see how many benefit dues he seems to go to. And I think it's sort of, you know, I don't want to start a Kevin Peterson debate, but it's an interesting sort of look at the fact that a lot of this talk about him being, you know, selfish, and he does seem to make a real effort with his former England colleagues to turn up to these things.
But a lot of these, presumably a lot of these benefits in inverted commas that are happening nowadays aren't actually towards the... I mean, we've shifted from a system where when you read in, you know, any cricket book that you read that was written before 1960, the idea of the benefit, you know, will come in at some point because it was so vital. So all of those players who are age 36, if they've been playing cricket since they were 18, they had no formal qualifications whatsoever. They suddenly left the game and, you know, what is it that they do? You know, they kind of have no idea, and they are sort of washed up in the world, and actually, you know, the money, as you say, from the benefit goes towards them investing in something that they can then make money from in the future. What we've moved towards, though, with these kinds of people and the idea of Kevin Peterson going to a benefit is not, you know, when Alistair Cook retires, he's not going to be short a penny or two.
No.
And that actually fundamentally the idea of the benefit, I mean, I don't even, do you know if even actually kind of standard county pros who haven't seen the international stage still in 2016 have benefits? Because I'm not sure that they do
Yeah, so there
in the
does
same way.
there seems to be a clear divide. The idea of the benefit is still very, very popular. The idea after your 10 years of service, you get your benefit, and that is still very much kept on. But in terms of what happens to the money, there is a bit of a divide. So to give you an example, Ravi Bapara had his benefit last year, and he was very, very clear. You know, I've been a lucky guy. I've played for England. I've played in the IPL. His was all, I think all the money from that went to charity. Now, for your
Right.
more standard county pro, someone like Tim Murta, who had a benefit last year from Middlesex, that I think was the more standard model now, where he kept some of the money and some of it was donated to charity. Now, what's particularly interesting, I think, is all the players having benefits now seem to make a big donation to the PCA Benevolent Fund, which is a charity for supporting former players who've fallen on hard times. And I think this is quite a nice model because it's a way of sort of the haves supporting the have-nots in cricket. And I think it is worth noting, overwhelmingly, cricketers now are much better off than they were. But actually, there obviously are some players who still leave the game and have struggles.
And is
Now.
that the sorry, you made a reference to 10 years. Is that generally the kind of accepted,
Yeah.
length of time that you need to get at within a club, by
So
which time they'll give you a benefit season?
the distinction that most counties have is that you get a benefit after 10 years, but just to confuse things slightly, if you do less than 10 years but they still think you deserve something, they award you a testimonial. Just to confuse things even further, they try to
Sorry, what's the
avoid.
difference? Sorry, just quickly, what's the difference between a benefit and a testimonial?
I don't think there is any practical difference in terms of what happens.
Okay,
I
okay.
think basically a benefit after 10 years, there is kind of no debate. You get your
It's just an
season.
automatic
A
thing.
pretty much. I think a
Yeah.
testimonial is more, okay, you're not going to have managed 10 years from us because you're leaving the you're too old, you're retiring or whatever, but we still think you deserve it. Just to further
Okay.
confuse this, they try and avoid players from the same county having benefits in the same season because you can just imagine they end up
Yeah.
their events end up clashing with
Competing
each
against one
other, and
another.
exactly, and it would make you feel sad if everyone goes to Alistair Cook's dinner and no one comes to yours.
Indeed. And it, and is and are is are all of the earnings that are made from benefits treated as kind of earnings in the same way that any other money that players earn?
Now, George Osborne has taken a rather surprising interest. Britain's Chancellor has taken a rather surprising interest in the benefit season in the last couple of years. Because back in 1927, Kent's James Seymour won a landmark court case against the Inland Revenue, allowing him not to pay income tax on his benefit earnings of £939. As a little aside, Seymour spent this on a fruit farm, so it was money well spent. Now, for 90 years, almost 90 years, Seymour's precedent has protected the benefit earnings of cricketers, but as of November 2015 budget, George Osborne brought an end to this arrangement. Benefit earnings up to £50,000 will remain protected. Anything beyond this will be taxable. And I think this is very much in recognition of the fact that cricketers are not sort of the situation has changed. And I think while there will undoubtedly be grumbles around the shires in this, I think the reason at the heart of this is one to be celebrated. Cricketers are generally far better off than they used to be, and no longer need to be charity cases. To the review, and for this episode, we've been reading 10 for 10, Headley Verity and the Story of Cricket's Greatest Bowling Feat by Chris Waters. Waters is the long-standing cricket correspondent for the Yorkshire Post. His first book was Fred Trueman, the Authorised Biography, which received widespread acclaim, including the 2012 Wisdom Book of the Year, and far, far more importantly, a rave review here on Reverse Threat Radio.
So, 10 for 10 is the story of Headley Verity's incredible feat, which is unsurpassed to this day, of taking all 10 wickets in an innings and conceding just 10 runs while doing so. He did this in a county game between Yorkshire and Nottinghamshire. He was, of course, a Yorkshire man, and this match happened at Headingley in 1932. What's particularly touching about this book is the fact that it was the dying wish of Headley Verity's son, Douglas, that it be written. And Waters has, clearly has a really strong affection and affinity for his subject that's kind of shines through throughout the book. And actually, it was something that kind of worried me when I first started reading the book, because often when you get authors who really want to focus on a particular, a particular theme, a particular topic, something as small as, one bowler's performance in a day, and they want to spread it out over 150 pages, that sometimes you think that their enthusiasm for the subject can sort of outlast the reader's enthusiasm for the subject. But actually, I thought that this book was really a model of how you take a single event and you talk about it in context. You talk about, it's a, this is a book about verity. It's a book about actually England in the 1930s as much
Well,
as anything
you
else, but
get.
it has as its centerpiece this incredible performance.
Yeah, because it actually, the performance acts as a way into lots of wonderful biographies of the players who were involved in that game. It acts as a wonderful, as you say, insight into the time. There's lots of character. And of course, the book, it's bookended by the beginning and fairly tragic end of Verity's life as well. I think one of the things that struck me is that Waters has not only written a tribute to Headley's brilliance, but also a tribute to the cricket writers of the time who were recording this event. The big names are all there: Cardus, Kilburn, Robertson, Glasgow, all get regularly quoted. But most attention is actually reserved to the correspondence of the local papers. And now, while Waters never makes the point explicitly, I can't help feeling that as a local cricket correspondent, he's hinting pretty strongly that, at the moment we're losing so many local cricket writers. This book really makes a case for how important these guys are in recording the
Absolutely.
career.
And there are actually a whole number of kind of passages and single sentences that are quoted from cricket literature that you read and you sort of think, oh, I must remember that. I mean, I've now forgotten them, as I always do. When
Well,
anyone tells me a good joke, I
yes.
immediately forget
Well,
them, and I think I must remember it. But particularly some of the Neville Carters and J.M. Kilburn as well. Some
I'll
of his quotations, J.M. Kilburn and erstwhile chief cricket correspondent for the Yorkshire Post, actually a predecessor of Waters as well.
The other thing is that Waters' own writing stands up incredibly well against some of these greats, and I don't think you could give him a higher compliment than that. I'll just give you two quick ones to give you the chance to compare and contrast. So the great Robertson Glasgow described Herbert Sutcliffe as the sort of man who would rather miss a train than run for it, and so be seen in disorder and heard breathing heavily. And then only 2 pages later, you get Waters describing the bowler Macaulay, and I think this is as good as anything as these writers of these eras. Macaulay was the sort of man who might have picked a fight with his own shadow and then immediately offered to buy it a drink, rough and ready, with wafer-thin lips made for wedging woodbines. I mean, it's sensational stuff.
One of the obviously at the center of the book is this remarkable achievement of Hedley Verity's that, as I said, has been unsurpassed to this day, of not only taking 10 wickets in the innings but also only conceding 10 runs while doing so. One of the things that I think Waters is kind of really interesting and really honest about is the kind of blink and you'll miss it nature of events like this. The book starts with him visiting people who, the last person who played in that game, and indeed someone who was in the last person to be alive who played in that game, and indeed someone who was in the crowd that day. And the remarkable thing that comes across is just the sense that even though there was a big crowd for this match, and indeed he makes the remarkable observation that there are as many people watching this county game as there were, I think, watching the 2005 Headingley Ashes Test on the first day. It's sort of 35,000 people or something like that. And he just makes the point that actually that there are these moments of, in cricket that no one can expect. No one knew that that was going to happen on that day. In many ways, it looked like a bit of a washout, that match. Yorkshire had declared earlier that day to try and force some sort of a game, but it was never going to be an exciting match. And then suddenly, out of nowhere, this absolutely kind of astonishing event happens. And I think that's one of the strengths of this book that Waters has, is that he doesn't treat this game as suddenly as this kind of shining example of cricket at its very best. It's an example of the ability of cricket to sort of surprise out of nowhere.
And I think he's also very surprising the fact that actually after the game there weren't endless quotes by Verity on his achievement. And Waters contrasts that with this modern obsession with, after every single game and every single day's cricket, Sky has to get 1,000 quotes from anyone who did anything halfway worthy that day. And I think it's clear which side Waters' sympathy is on.
Indeed, and actually, one of the other interesting things reading this book is that I mean, you think of 1932, obviously, we've got Bodyline the next year. We've got, when you think of sort of the ages of great English bowlers, you're kind of up there at that point. You've got obviously Harold Larwood indeed playing in this game for Nottinghamshire on the opposite side to Hedley Verity, and about to go down and perpetrate Bodyline, if we can use that loaded word. And actually, this is a a kind of a book full of heroes. There are so many people who are kind of involved in this story one way or other, who are heroes. And actually, Verity himself and the heroic aspects of Verity as the heir to Wilfred Rhodes comes across quite strongly in that as well, I think.
Well, I think it's very interesting to see that our modern obsession with wanting to replace old heroes is very true, is remained true then. So you have the fact that today we're always talking about the new Botham, and Verity sort of suffered with this as well. I think Rhodes had a wonderful line for dismissing this. When asked whether there was any bowl that Heraty bowled that he didn't himself bowl, Rhodes replied, "Aye, there was the ball they cut for four." And Water sums it up very nicely when he said, "Verity was never a second Rhodes, but always a first Verity." I think if we can, I know it's a very, very different book to the Truman biography. My slight worry at times was that, in comparison, Verity is a fascinating figure, but he's not quite as complex, I think, or as intriguing as Truman. But I
He didn't
think,
drink for a start.
no, well, he didn't quite have. With Truman, there seemed to constantly be these two sides of his personality, whereas Verity seemed much more kind of straight up. But I think Water still does tease out the complexity that's there. I mean, I particularly enjoyed this stuff about how Verity just loved the mental struggle of cricket. There's a long paragraph where he's described as a sort of Sherlock Holmes figure. You know, he revelled in the intellectual side of it, almost to the point that where a couple of cricket correspondents at the time thought he did that too much. You know, he'd have been better off just, you know, bowling it, giving it a tweak, and seeing what happened sometimes. But he always wanted to intellectualise it.
And that for me is one of the real strengths of this book, that even though 10 for 10, the idea of taking 10 wickets and conceding only 10 runs is a real kind of headline, as it were, that actually this book doesn't go for the headlines all the way through it. And actually what it does is it paints a really subtle and sensitive picture of a man who, as you've just referred to, wasn't someone who could be painted in headlines. He wasn't larger than life. He was kind of, you know, and actually at the end of the book, Waters kind of says it slightly sheepishly, you know, he was the kind of man who no one had a bad word to say about.
So I think the best way to conclude is I think we're extremely excited to see which great figure in Yorkshire history Waters chooses to profile next.
So that was the 79th
Episode.
episode, would you believe it, of Reverse Web Radio. Gosh, quite a range of topics we managed to cover then. Thank you for bearing with us as we did so.
Yeah, get in
As
touch with
ever.
us on Twitter at Reverse Swept. And also, if you did enjoy the episode, please head to iTunes and write us a lovely review.